You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1979 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fourth class in a series given by Brother John Peek on the subject, True Principles in an Unprincipled World.
About at the end of the last period, on the subject under 3H here, the fact that God is demanding and jealous. Pardon me. And God's demands upon us at times may seem rather severe. Certainly the Israelites found them so, and they chafed under the rigor of God's requirements, and they disobeyed. As also so do we. And it's very easy for us in the comparatively easy times in which we live to look back on those Israelites in the wilderness and say, what a stupid bunch of people. Here they had the visible hand of God revealed to them. Why did they do those foolish things? Well, the fact is, human nature never changes, basically. The only change that can be wrought in human nature is that which individuals bring about upon themselves. Whenever you have an aggregation of human beings, you have a statistical setup. You're going to have everything varying all the way from one extreme to the other. A very high level of obedience, as with Caleb and Joshua. Then you have your bell-shaped curve and taper off to the rebels like Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And this is true today within our own body. It is just natural for the flesh to resent being restrained. Just watch some of these small children around here. And every parent knows how difficult it is to restrain them. But after all, we're all children, relatively speaking. Some may be bigger than others. Some may have lived a little longer than others. But basically, we are all children. And hopefully, children of God. But as every wise parent knows, as we were touching upon last time, there have to be standards set and adhered to. And part of the problem that the young people in recent years have been experiencing is the fact that their parents did not set rigid standards for them. They indulged them. And so the kids were left in a state of continual uncertainty and frustration. They didn't know for sure what was right and what was wrong. And always, they're continually testing, to see just what they can get away with. Trying to find out where the electric fence is, so to speak. Parents sometimes forbear to discipline their children as they should be, thinking that they have such great love for them. But I raise the honest question, is this love for the child? Actually, it's been discovered by psychologists that young people want discipline, though they'd never admit it to you, of course, because it gives them a feeling of security. And when they're continually in doubt and don't know where the bounds are that they may not overstep, they are frustrated. And so they are likely to overstep them. Severity and the strictness of discipline is in no way inconsistent with love. In fact, it is a manifestation of love. It shows the child that the parent loves him or her because you take that much interest in them. If you just turn them loose and let them do what they want to, you're telling them that you really don't care all that much. I said facetiously at a gathering to a friend, some friends of ours, it seemed to me that gatherings were for the purpose of the young parents getting together and yakking and just turning their kids loose to do whatever they wanted to. That, of course, was an exaggeration, but sometimes you exaggerate to try to make a point. And as Paul says, as was mentioned yesterday, behold the goodness and severity of God. And, of course, he makes a difference. To thee, that is to those blessed with the gospel, God's goodness, but on them that fell, severity. So there has to be a standard set. It has to be adhered to, and just as soon as the standards begin to break down, then you have chaos. Creeping chaos, such as this country and others are experiencing. Passing on then to the next point, the fact that God is invisible to mortals. This, of course, needs no proof. But it does have this important aspect, and that is there are many people who pride themselves on their agnosticism. Their motto is, seeing is believing. The implication being, what I can't see, I will not believe. Well, this is a foolish attitude. There are a lot of things you can't see. You can't see your food digest, yet you believe it does. You can't hear programs that are on radio and television that are sailing over our heads all the time, but just because you can't hear them, does this mean they do not exist? Of course it doesn't. So, sensate perception is not the only kind of perception there is. And the human mind was so constituted by the Creator that we can go beyond the sensate, that which you can actually touch and feel and see and hear and smell, so that we can think in the abstract, things that are not clearly visible. And, of course, mathematics is an example of an abstract science or exercise or reasoning. Yet it definitely can be applied as we apply it every day. And the fact that it is abstract in no way belies its existence. But it is a temptation to people who are looking for an excuse for not believing. And this kind of people God has no interest in at all. They are really doing little more, in essence, than the animals do, because they go and operate in their lives on the basis of sensing abilities. That's the way they find their food, the way they find their mates, and everything else. God requires faith. And with the ability to sense spiritually, intellectually, morally, that God exists, that he has requirements, that he has a right to make a demand upon our obedience. This ability we have. however much we may try to deny it to ourselves and to others. And this is the kind of thing that faith is based upon. As it says in that beginning of that famous 11th chapter of Hebrews, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And it's better rendered in some of the other translations. But explaining that verse takes a long time, and I probably wearied some of you 3 years ago when I was going over that in this Bible school. So, we can definitely believe what we cannot see. We can hope for what we cannot see. Now, in their discussions of the first chapter of 1 John, the brethren have pointed out, as John points out there, that which was from the beginning, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have heard our hands handled of the word of life, those disciples had direct evidence that they could sense of an immortalized human being. You might say they didn't have to take it on faith, though faith was indeed required of them. But we have to remember that they had a commission to carry out, which made tremendous demands upon them, tremendous sacrifices, tremendous suffering. But we have other kinds of evidence to support our faith, the evidence of fulfilled prophecy, the evidence of the internal consistency of the Word of God, the psychological truth that it teaches, because the Bible is the best text on psychology that was ever written. It's the best text on history. In fact, it is the newest old book in the world, because it's not only up to date, it's ahead of the date in what it tells us can happen. So really, God's invisibility should not cause us any trouble. In fact, it's an absolute necessity, because as it is written, no man can look upon God and live. So it's a merciful thing that we can't behold Him with our eyes. We'd be struck dead. And only those who attain unto the divine nature can or will be able to see God in with their senses. Today, we can see Him, but not sensationally or by sensate means. We see Him as we say, we use the figure, the eye of faith. All right, going on then to page 3 of the outline. We have the fact that has been touched upon by others, that God has manifested Himself in beings other than Himself, and that a very crucial part of His purpose, and that which should concern us particularly, is that He will manifest Himself in a great multitude, the units of which are being taken out, selected throughout the ages. James said that God did visit the Gentiles to take out of them a people for His name. These are people who, if they succeed in overcoming their innate human weaknesses, God will manifest Himself in as a great multitude. And the captain of their salvation has been put through the test and proved successful, and has become the firstborn among many brethren. And as I believe Brother Chuck said yesterday, the I will be who I will be, or that I will be, is an expression of God's purpose. It is a part or one aspect of His name, because His name involves His purpose. And we should, the more we dig into the Scriptures, the more we understand of the plan and purpose of God, the more we understand ourselves and our weaknesses, the greater the wonder becomes that God would condescend to look upon us weak and erring mortals. It is a great mystery that He should have such a good purpose with us, because we certainly don't deserve it. There's not one of us that deserves salvation, however much some people might think they do. It is only by the grace of God that we even live here and now. As our brother said in his prayer this morning, we depend upon God for our daily food and other things. Or as it is said, if He take unto Himself His Spirit and His breath, all flesh should perish from the earth, and man should turn again unto the dust. And as Paul said, in Him we live and move and have our being. And so, it is our hope to become a part of God manifest. This is something that, as you delve more deeply into it, the greater wonder of it, the greater beauty of it, the overwhelming joy comes to us of such a merciful and gracious Creator. Now, those who wish to delve deeply, we have given you a couple of Dr. Thomas's writings that you can peruse and hopefully get interested enough to study carefully, Phanerosis and Eureka. I hear people say they can't understand the Eureka. Actually, I don't think there was ever a more lucid writer than Dr. Thomas in the truth literature. Sure, he throws in some Greek words, but you don't have to worry about the Greek alphabet. He gives the English equivalent of it. And from that, this can enrich your understanding of even our own language and the language used in the Scriptures. It is a fascinating study, and once you cut your teeth on it, then you can manage to really enjoy it. I have certainly found the Eureka a fascinating study. And it isn't only about revelation. It's really about the whole body of truth, is it not? Those of you who have taken the trouble to study it. Because He, to use a slang expression, covers the waterfront in that treatise. That's one reason it's as large as it is. Alright, so with this superficial treatment of the first part here of this series of discussions, we want to pass on to something that is less firmly based upon scriptural teaching. And I freely confess there is some personal interpretation in this, and therefore it is in no way to be considered infallible. But after all, the ecclesial guide is something which was written by a man without inspiration. It presents the deductions of Brother Robert Roberts as to what he thought was the proper way in which ecclesia should be operated. And I think he did a very good job of it. We don't consider it absolutely flawless. It, like anything else, has to be read with understanding and interpretation to apply it to situations that arise. So with all the limitations that may be inherent in what we have here, let's consider some of these things. And I'm sure that as we get into this, this is going to generate in some of you some adverse opinions and so forth. And if you have them, bring them out. I realize that I have done so much talking here, and even though I invited questions, I haven't really given you a chance. Either you're too polite to interrupt me, as I invited you to do, or else I have more or less snowed you here so that you haven't been willing to say anything or afraid to say it. I heartily enjoy discussion, and I can entertain differences of opinion charitably, I believe, where there is good reason for them. So let's talk then about one's personal relationship within the ecclesia. And here we're getting down then to the practical nitty-gritty business of living within the Christadelphian body. And I want to start out right now with a statement which may surprise some of you. As I suppose most of you know, I've been involved in the reunion effort, have been for the last 25 years almost. And this is my own opinion. I believe that the true body of Christ is not divided. The only thing that is divided is human organizations which lay claim to being the body of Christ. As it is written, the firm foundation of God standeth sure, having this seal, the Lord knoweth them that are His. And just because we happen to belong to an organization with a big fancy name doesn't necessarily mean that we are one of His. Alright, so we say here that the ecclesia is a temporal institution, temporary, intended for the service and welfare of its constituent members, that is, those who are members of the ecclesia. In other words, as we all know, an ecclesia is made up of individuals. It's an aggregation, shall we say. Now, there's a difference between, of course, an aggregation and a team. A team has an unifying purpose and rules of operation. An aggregation does not necessarily have such. But I think we will all agree that each ecclesia should be, as we use the term today, a team, should it not? Working to accomplish a definite purpose. Any athletic team has the purpose of making points in one way or another so as to obtain a victory, either for fun or for money. And this requires cooperation, particularly when they become professional and work for money. Now, what is it, then, that binds us together as an ecclesia? As you know, the word ecclesia comes from the Greek directly, from ek, meaning out of, and klesis, meaning called. I believe, Chuck, you can correct me if my Greek is incorrect. In other words, it is an assembly of called out ones. called out from what and for what? Well, as we talked yesterday on the subject of holiness, called out from the world and called out to the service of God and their Lord. And this is something that it can be forgotten. Every organization of any size in the world usually has what we might call a charter and or a constitution. And the charter defines the purpose for which the organization exists. So what is the purpose of the ecclesia? Well, the purpose of the ecclesia is to aid its members and to have the members interact with one another constructively for the accomplishment of their own salvation, in their own individual salvations. Because as we say here under D, salvation is a strictly individual matter. It's not an ecclesial one. Salvation, where attainable, is not temporal. Of course, we are in this temporal state hoping for salvation, but once salvation is granted and accomplished, that is permanent. Well, now, if the ecclesia is going to be for the service and to aid the individual members, each to attain his or her own salvation, it doesn't take too much intelligence to realize that the atmosphere or spirit, as we may term it, of the ecclesia should be a healthy and constructive one. And as we said the other day, no one in this world achieves success unless he has a goal, a clear goal, something that he wants desperately to accomplish and will bend every effort toward that accomplishment and not permitting other things to interfere in that effort to attain that goal. Shouldn't an ecclesia have a goal then? I think it should. The Christadelphian body should have a goal. And as we, that goal is the one that I have mentioned a couple of times, in helping individuals to attain salvation. Does the ecclesia exist for the individuals, or do the individuals exist for the ecclesia? Well, I think what I've already said gives you an obvious answer to that. So there must be a unity of objective here, of not only the ecclesia as a body, but also in its relationship to the individuals. It should be constructive. In other words, it should be helpful. If the ecclesia is truly fulfilling its proper objective, would the attending of meetings then, for any sincere believer, be logically a pleasant experience or an unhappy one? Well, it should certainly be pleasant, should it not? And yet we know, we have been told, of one ecclesia, I'm not going to give you the slightest idea where it is, where the atmosphere is so bad that members have to spend most of the week psyching themselves up to attend the meeting and to endure all the unpleasantness associated therewith. Is that ecclesia fulfilling its charter, its purpose? Would you not say that its effect is negative rather than positive? Now, it is when individuals and organizations forget their goal, where the purpose of it all becomes hazy or fuzzy, because it has largely been neglected, that the organization begins to decline, and the standards of the guidelines, to use labor management terms, become bent, do they not? In other words, it finally becomes a question of anything goes, particularly if you can get away with it. Well, no true, sincere believer in God and in Christ should be trying or testing to see just how much he or she can get away with. This is entirely the wrong attitude. Not only should the ecclesia be for positive influence that it can exert upon its individual members, it should also serve as a light stand. If you remember the figure used by Jesus in the book of Revelation, he speaks of himself as he that walks among the seven golden candlesticks or light stands. And as Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, ye are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid, neither do men light a lamp and put it under a bushel or under a bed, but on a stand, that it may give light to all that are in the house. And of course, in the tabernacle in the wilderness, which was an enclosure that would otherwise be totally dark were it not for the seven-branched lampstand or candlestick with little oil lamps burning there, that was the only visible light in the holy place. And it symbolizes the role that our ecclesias should perform, because it can be a very positive influence on behalf of our master, in influencing people of the world to see that here is a group of people who behave as or in accordance with what the Bible teaches. And I think we all know of instances where people have come and joined certain ecclesias on the basis of what they observed as the spirit that prevailed in a certain group. And I'm almost positive, though I can't give you documentary evidence of the fact, that I'm sure that there are people who might have come to the knowledge of the truth and service of Christ who were turned off completely when they saw what went on in some ecclesial meetings. Because you can just sniff the atmosphere of an organization pretty quickly, can't you? It's almost like any room in a house. You soon catch the aroma of the place. Now, the individual members of the ecclesia have their duty to the ecclesia, just as well as the ecclesia has its duty to its individual members.
It is their duty to support the ecclesia, to be ready and willing unto every good work. Since it is a body made up of parts, each part may not have the same function. And of course we have Paul's use of this figure of the human body in his letter to the Corinthians. It has many members and they have differing functions. Some can do one thing better than others, and I'm sure in any active ecclesia there is opportunity for any good proper function to be that can be performed to be performed by someone. Granted, some operations or functions are more, shall we say, prestigious than others. For example, the brethren who exhort or lecture are perhaps looked up to by others. But does this mean that they are more important than certain other members of the ecclesia who maybe do the work in the kitchen or keep the place clean and so forth? I don't think so. But we're dealing with a body of human beings. And a body of human beings is a collection of egos. And the ego will, in its own devious ways, seek means of expression. And this is what causes conflicts and trouble. As Paul said to the Corinthians, "For whereas there is among you envy and strife and division, are ye not carnal and walk as men?" And Brother Peter Reynolds, in the famous exhortation that he gave many years ago in Birmingham, says that this is the inevitable order. There is no other order. It starts with envy, which leads to strife, which leads to division. Well, what place does envy have? No proper place at all. Paul says it's idolatry. And why is it idolatry? Or what is an idol? An idol is anything that is set up in opposition to God or to God's worship. So whenever we envy someone else, we are making either that person or what he has or the position that he occupies something that we would desire, that we would grasp for. And human nature being what it is, and the almost irrepressible ego that most of us have, and that some of us never seem to be able to bring under control, there is bound to be the desire for preeminence. And if you remember, John speaks about this in one of his epistles. Now, we've heard it said here that we are not to be primarily servants. Well, we can understand this in several ways. Jesus says, as I remember very well, "Ye are my friends if ye do whatsoever I command you. Henceforth I call you not servants." But of course the word translated servants means basically slaves, does it not? We can serve without being servile. We can serve in many capacities. In fact, to have a truly enjoyable life, it must involve service of some kind in one way or another. For example, as parents, we serve our children for a long time, do we not? Until they are able to be turned loose on their own. And the service of God is in no way a degrading thing. Nor is it a degrading thing to serve the ecclesia, no matter how apparently humble the form of service may be. And just because it is less prestigious does not mean it is not valuable. Tom was speaking facetiously yesterday about the kids doing or not doing the dishes and so forth, and the situation the house gets in. If nobody did the janitor work around the ecclesia, it would soon be in a mess. And there are various kinds of janitor work. There are various kinds of messes to be cleaned up, both physical and psychological. So we should consider ourselves servants, first to God, then to our Master, and then to our brethren and sisters. And none of those three forms of service is demeaning in any way. In fact, it's exactly the contrary. It is ennobling. It is through service that we overcome selfishness. And selfishness is something that is not at all pleasing to God. And some of the most lovable characters that we know are those who have demonstrated their unselfishness in service to others. Now, as Paul said to the Corinthians, where they were having fights among themselves, he said he desired that they all speak the same thing. And when he says speak the same thing, he means to be of one mind, particularly as regards to important doctrinal matters. Now the question becomes, how far must we go in speaking the same thing, and where is a little latitude permitted? And here we have to have some standards, I think. What is the difference between what we call the truth and what was called the errors of Christendom by the founding fathers of the Christadelphian body? It is that we understand and believe certain doctrines that are clearly demonstrable from the Holy Scriptures. We call them, first, principles. And I think that it is absolutely necessary that we all speak the same thing with regard to first principles. But the Bible is far more than a collection of texts on what we call first principles. There are many things in the Bible which need interpretation. And interpretation brings into it the element of putting some of our own understanding into what is said. Let me just illustrate. When the Bible says, as in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill, does this require interpretation? I don't think so. It is very clear and explicit. But and on those things, there should be absolutely no deviation at all. And if an ecclesia begins to deviate on these things and hedge on them and allow departure, then we're in for trouble. But when we come to passages requiring some interpretation, and things can be understood in slightly different ways, and the best example of this, of course, is in the interpretation of prophecy. Do we have any right to be dogmatic on those things and say prophecy must be interpreted the way I interpret it? No, because we never know for sure how prophecy is going to be fulfilled until it has been fulfilled. So therefore, it is not only foolish, but presumptuous to be dogmatic as to how it is going to happen. And yet, to expound prophecy can minister to an individual's ego, particularly if he thinks he understands more about prophecy than other people. We have known cases where close friendships were destroyed because one brother came to a different understanding of how certain prophecies might be interpreted than another brother. And the brother from whose interpretation the one brother differed, took it as a personal affront to him. I'll identify myself with one of these brethren, but I'm not going to tell you who the other one is. Let's just take one case in point. Who are the kings of the East, spoken of in Revelation 16, where the great river Euphrates is to be dried up to make way for the kings of the East? Those of us who've studied Eureka know what Dr. Thomas's interpretation is, but other brethren have had other interpretations of it. But it is certainly nothing to fight about, is it? Or to become offended about if somebody sees it differently from the way that we see it. So to summarize this point, I'm putting a lot of my own interpretation into what seems to be proper here, and it is therefore fallible. I believe that where interpretation is involved, then there should be allowance made, and we should not say, unless you agree with this interpretation, you are cut off from fellowship. That is presumption. On the other hand, if someone kills somebody else, I don't think there should be any question about it at all. Now, for an ecclesia to prosper, it must be, first of all, healthy. We said it exists for the benefit of its members, for building them up, for edifying, which is a synonym for building up, and helping them to attain salvation. How long does an ecclesia retain its health? Well, let's just take physical existence. When are we the healthiest? It's when we're young, is it not? We start, life is a process of living cells dying and being replaced by other cells. But when we're young, we start out at a tremendous rate of cell growth and multiplication. Then around age 25, we reach a peak when the two processes, the anabolic and the catabolic processes, go at the same rate. And from then on, it's slide down the hill. And I'm way down the hill. Well, what an ecclesia needs to do is to make intelligent use of two things: the vitality of its young brethren and the wisdom of some of its old brethren, if it has old brethren who have acquired wisdom. And the two should be able to work together as a team, though that isn't easy in all cases. There's a restaurant in a little town called Marshall, Michigan. It is, and some of you I've told this to before, it is a German restaurant. Its name is Schuller's, and it has a beautiful dining room with massive oak beam ceilings. And on these oak beams, there are little mottos written in gold letters. And one that I always remember is, "In the mind of youth, all his elders are senile." And so youth, in its exuberance, in its feeling that it is the only thing that can get anything done, it is inclined to discount the wisdom of the older brethren. And the other side of the coin is, the older brethren are likely to look at some of the younger brethren and consider them mavericks who just want to get overthrow the establishment. And of course, neither of those attitudes is constructive. It is indeed very hard for young brethren, particularly when they're very intelligent, to restrain their ambitions for prominence, for public exposure, and so forth. And this is one of the trials of youth, to learn this degree of humility that is necessary. But it can be done. In other words, if you have an entrenched hierarchy, if I may use that term, of older brethren who will not allow any deviation from the way they say it has got to be, you're going to have unrest and possibly rebellion take place. Well, our time is up.